Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll hear about the efforts to regulate corporate lobbying and develop community bills of rights to help local communities wrest their governments from corporate influence. But first, this news. A wildfire near Superior, Montana has grown to 7 square miles as of this morning. Fire information officers say fire crews have made good progress keeping the fire from burning into the town of Superior, but some structures are threatened. Crews built between 6 and 7 miles of fire line along the southwestern edge of the fire. The official Idaho unemployment rate inched up 0.2 percentage points between May and June, and now stands at 6.4%. The monthly increase is the first for the state since September 2011. The State Department of Labor says 1,900 more workers were getting unemployment benefits in the state in June than the month before, bringing the number to 49,000. Unemployment rates do not include those who have stopped looking for work or who have never been part of the labor force. 38 out of 44 Idaho counties had higher unemployment rates in June than in May. Moscow City Clerk Stephanie Kalaz has announced the filing window for those considering a run for 3 open seats on the 6-seat Moscow City Council or the mayor's seat. Candidates must file their declarations of candidacy between Monday, August 26th and Friday, September 6th. At 5 p.m. Candidates must have resided within the Moscow City limits at least 30 days and must submit a non-refundable $40 fee or a petition of candidacy signed by at least 5 qualified city voters. Candidates can submit an appointment and certification of political treasurer form now. Once that form is submitted, fundraising for a candidate can begin. So far, current City Council member Walter Steed and former Council member John Weber have indicated they intend to run for re-election. Planning and Zoning Commission Chair Art Bedke also says he will run for City Council. Current Council members Sue Scott and Tim Brown have indicated they will not run for re-election. Council members Tom Lamar, Wayne Krause, and Dan Karskalin are not up for re-election this year and will have 2 years remaining in their terms as of next January. All city elected positions have 4-year terms. In Moscow City elections, all candidates run at large, and the top 3 vote-getters for city council seats will get seats on the council. Magistrate John Judge yesterday set a Monday, August 19th arraignment date for 42-year-old Brian K. Taylor of Moscow, who is accused of 3 felony counts of lewd conduct with a minor under the age of 16, plus 2 felony counts of male rape and 2 felony sexual exploitation of a child charges. Taylor was arrested June 11th after a child mentioned him during a school program on domestic safety. Prosecutors say there is evidence Taylor had sexual contact with 3 minors. Taylor is also charged with felony possession of methamphetamine. Lewiston attorney Richard M. Cudahy filed a motion in district court in Lewiston yesterday asking murder charges against his client, 29-year-old Natasha Hodges of Lewiston, be dismissed due to multiple acts of misconduct by Nez Perce County Senior Deputy Prosecutor Sandra K. Dickerson during grand jury proceedings. Cudahy wrote in his motion, Dickerson's conduct amounted to a, quote, heinous instance of grand jury manipulation. Hodges is accused of killing 2-year-old Riley Mingo, who she was babysitting, on August 30th of last year. Court records say Hodges called an ambulance after Mingo had breathing difficulty and the toddler died at St. Joseph Regional Medical Center in Lewiston. Lewiston police say Mingo died of internal bleeding and had an apparent abdominal injury. Cudahy said Dickerson presented inadmissible evidence and submitted no direct evidence implicating Hodges. Dickerson implicated Hodges because of the belief she was the only person around who could have hurt Mingo. Lewiston Police Sergeant Jeff Arneson testified Hodges, quote, was the only adult who had an opportunity to inflict any pain or hurt Riley, in my opinion. Cudahy's motion says Dickerson's intent was to create a biased grand jury, and she did so by steering the grand jury away from questioning witnesses who could point to other explanations for Mingo's death. He also said the prosecutor presented inadmissible evidence to establish probable cause. Hodges' trial has been scheduled for March 10th of next year. She is currently free on a $50,000 bond. University of Idaho archaeology students will show artifacts collected at the Kuski internment camp, which held male U.S. residents of Japanese lineage during World War II, at a presentation tomorrow in Lowell. UI Assistant Anthropology Professor Stacy Camp says five graduate students and 13 undergraduates have been excavating a location near the camp's incinerator for the last 3 years, finding artwork, ceramics, gaming pieces, and porcelain, much of it from Japan. Camp said some of the artifacts were found unburied on the ground. The Kuski internment camp was the subject of a 2010 book by University of Idaho historical anthropologist Priscilla Weggers called Imprisoned in Paradise, Japanese Roadworkers at the Kuski Internment Camp. Weggers depended mostly on historical documents and interviews to research her book. The camp housed 256 Japanese-American men who were used for labor, mainly building U.S. Highway 12 connecting the area with Montana. Camp says it will take about a year to properly clean the artifacts and get them ready for a process which will help determine their dates of origin. Camp and her students will give a presentation about the internment camp's history tomorrow from 10:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the Three Rivers Resort in Lowell, which is about 24 miles east of the Kuski internment camp site. Idaho's other World War II-era Japanese-American internment camp was the Minidoka Relocation Center near Twin Falls, which held 9,000 prisoners on 950 acres. The Environmental Protection Agency has issued draft wastewater permits for the cities of Coeur d'Alene, Post Falls, and the Hayden Area Regional Sewer District to reduce phosphorus flowing into the Spokane River. The new, stricter permits will require each of the entities to spend millions to upgrade their water treatment plants to bring their discharges into compliance with the Federal Clean Water Act. The stricter discharge limits will be phased in over 10 years. The Latah County Sheriff's Department reports a 22-year-old Moscow man severely injured his hand when he attempted to detonate a makeshift pipe bomb at a rural location Wednesday night. Latah County Sheriff Lieutenant Brannon Jordan told the Lewiston Tribune the unidentified man and his brother were parked on Darby Road when the large improvised firecracker made from PVC pipe and gunpowder exploded in one of the brother's hands when he ignited the device. Jordan said the men were videotaping at the time of the explosion. The man's brother then drove his injured brother to Gritman Medical Center, and doctors there called the Latah County Sheriff's Office. Lieutenant Jordan said the device was powerful enough to damage the vehicle along with the man's hand. Jordan said he's a very lucky man that he didn't sustain more serious injuries than he did. I'm sure the injuries he has will stay with him for the rest of his life. Jordan also said no charges have been filed at this point, but he said it's a felony to build devices like a pipe bomb. The names of the two men involved in the incident are being withheld while an investigation continues. Jordan said, "We're still in the process of investigating this, And what we'll do is package it all up and send it up to the prosecuting attorney to make any charges from there. Jordan added there has been no contact from the man's doctor about the severity of his hand injury. Jordan also was not sure if the injured man lost any of his fingers. Moscow police are reporting a collision by a 24-year-old Moscow man accidentally led them to a 49-year-old Moscow man who had an outstanding failure to appear warrant. Moscow Police Chief David Duke told the Moscow Pullman Daily News at about 3 a.m. yesterday, the driver of a 1994 Ford Explorer drove into a parked pickup truck on the 400 block of Quail Run Drive on the north end of Moscow. The collision caused a domino effect, and the 2002 Dodge truck plowed into the Explorer, which was pushed into another parked car, a 1988 Chevy Corvette, which pushed that vehicle into a garage door and then into a 2004 Yamaha motorcycle. The driver of the 1990 Explorer was transported to Gritman Medical Center with minor injuries. Duke said it appeared the man was intoxicated and hospital workers drew blood. Results of the test are pending. During the investigation, police discovered the owner of the Corvette was wanted on an outstanding Kootenai County bench warrant for failure to appear on an alleged inattentive driving charge. Duke said the men's names are being withheld pending results of the investigation. Latos Sanitation will begin distributing roll carts to households in the city of Moscow starting tomorrow. The new roll cart program for trash collection will begin August 1st. A press release from the city says trash from the roll carts will not be picked up until August 1st, and city residents should continue using their regular garbage cans until then. The roll carts will be delivered to the same curbside or alley spot where garbage cans are, along with an information packet explaining the new program. The size of roll carts will depend on how much garbage each household or duplex produces, and households will be charged based on the size of the roll cart. Those who do not produce enough trash for weekly pickup of the smallest 35-gallon roll cart can enroll in an a la carte program in which they are charged a rate based on the number of times per month they put out their trash for weekly pickup. The roll cart program will not be applied to apartment complexes that use dumpsters for trash. Residents who want to get rid of their old garbage cans once the roll cart system is functioning can bring them to the south gravel lot of the Moscow Recycling Center on Saturday, August 3rd and Saturday, August 10th between 9:30 a.m. and 3 p.m. Idaho Fish and Game officers darted a yearling moose and removed it from the city of Moscow yesterday. A second yearling moose, traveling with the other, left the city on its own as the Idaho Fish and Game Office watched to make sure the moose got all the way out of the city. According to Moscow Police Chief David Duke, the darted moose was relocated to an undisclosed location on federal lands. Duke told the Moscow Pullman Daily News the two animals were wandering on the University of Idaho campus for the past 3 days and were also walking into residential yards on Conestoga Drive. The moose were being monitored by fish and game officials on Wednesday before a decision was made to tranquilize and remove the animals. Duke said the moose that was darted was at Gormley Park when he was shot with the dart. The Daily News reports 4 moose have wandered into Moscow during the past year before the newest moose incursion. 2 moose were taken away from the area surrounding McDonald Elementary School in March of last year. Another moose was seen on the UI campus in October, and another was seen in the Moscow Cemetery in January. We now turn to our featured segments, both of which involve efforts to reduce corporate influence in local areas. First, we'll bring you part of an interview with Spokane Moves to Amend the Constitution organizer Chris Nerison, which occurred live on KRFP Monday night during the Climate Justice Forum radio program. Then we'll hear part of a talk by Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund organizer Kai Hushke of Spokane, who spoke with activists in Moscow February 1st about ways to combat corporate political hegemony in communities and about a possible community bill of rights. Spokane moves to amend the Constitution is gathering signatures to get a fair and clean elections initiative on the ballot in the city of Spokane, and a coalition including all three Spokane County Commissioners, three Spokane City Council members, business groups, and Avista have sued to keep the move to amend the Constitution initiative off the ballot. The coalition is also suing to prevent the Community Bill of Rights initiative from appearing on the ballot, and the organization behind the Community Bill of Rights, Envision Spokane, last week countersued the coalition, charging their strategic lawsuit against public participation, also known as a SLAP suit, would infringe on the group's First Amendment rights. Here's a portion of KRFP host Helen Yost's interview with Spokane Moves to Amend the Constitution organizer Chris Narrison.
It prohibits corporate lobbying, corporate involvement in initiatives, and corporate donations to candidates for elected office. Further into the ordinance, it requires that all communications between corporations and the city take place in an open forum, and that it's all submitted in legalese, and we've fulfilled all the legal requirements to get on the ballot. And we were thinking that we were going to get on the ballot, that we'd cleared the hoops of the city, and that the city had decided, the mayor and the city council apparently reached the conclusion that they were not going to sue to keep us off the ballot. But about a couple weeks ago, our agent was served with served papers notifying us that a group of businesses and some individuals in Spokane County had decided to file a lawsuit in an attempt to get an injunction to keep the initiative off the ballot. Motivations of the group suing us. Okay, they are, you know, the group, the business interests, and three members of the City of Spokane City Council and three county commissioners have joined in this lawsuit. And, you know, the one motivation is, like I said, they think it might be cheaper than running a campaign. And the other one, actually I wanted to address the lawsuit. So they are actually seeking an injunction because of the harm that they think this ordinance is going to do. Except the problem with their lawsuit is that you seek injunctions for imminent harm, okay? You have the right to go to court to get an injunction, to argue your case for an injunction for something that's going to cause imminent harm, okay? And if you can prove it to the judge will grant you an injunction. And what is so just off the mark with this particular lawsuit is that neither the Community Bill of Rights nor the Clean and Fair Elections Ordinance can do any harm before the election, right? I mean, there's going to be an election. And if it passes, then it would be reasonable to make arguments, you know, that this is going to do some harm, and you could make arguments. But they're trying to argue that something is going to cause imminent harm that hasn't even passed, that hasn't been voted on yet. And so it's an utterly preposterous legal position that they've taken. And there is a couple, I've been, you know, speaking with our attorney, and there is a couple of Supreme Court cases, Washington State Supreme Court cases, that back our position. It actually boils down to whether we get a liberal judge or a conservative judge in terms of how this ruling will go, because there is precedent in both directions. I think the stronger precedent is in our direction, and I also think the sort of, you know, common sense legal understanding that you can't get injunctions against things that don't exist, against harm that you can't prove. If we're ever going to get to a sustainable economy and some kind of sensible strategy for addressing our needs, on this planet, it has to include, severe and strict, tightly regulations on corporations and on what they can do. And it has to include limits on their legal power and on the privileges that are granted them through the law. And this corporate personhood is just corporate personhood and the idea that money is speech. You know, those are the two tallest trees in a forest of corporate privilege, okay? And that's, why I'm working on this particular issue. But I don't want any of the listeners to think that solving this issue solves all the problems, because it doesn't. It's just a start. It's the most egregious ones. We're working on this one because it's easy to understand. Polls have indicated 70-80% of the population agrees with me regarding that corporations are not people and money is not speech. And so from an organizing standpoint, that's easy to organize around, okay? And I think it's a doable goal. I think we're now at something like 14 or 15 states have passed either initiatives or state legislatures have passed resolutions calling for the reversal of the Citizens United decision. So the movement, it does have some traction. It is gaining ground, and it's just really, people are becoming more and more aware of it all the time, and I think that, that amendment, I think it's, I think it's a good possibility that it could happen. Hard to say when, but I think it will happen. But I don't think that's the end. I think that's the wrong attitude to think that, well, if we solve this, then, we're back to normal, everything's going to be fine. That's not true. I mean, we need to dig a lot deeper into this issue, but, we have to deal with one thing at a time, too.
That was Spokane Moves to Amend the Constitution organizer Chris Narrison speaking with Helen Yost, host of KRFP's Climate Justice Forum show earlier this week. Climate Justice Forum airs Mondays, 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. here on KRFP 92.5. We now turn to our other featured segment. On February 1st, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund organizer Kai Hushke of Spokane spoke with Moscow activists about ways to combat corporate political hegemony in communities about a possible community bill of rights. Here's a portion of Kai Hushke's talk.
One way to look at it is the work that's happening at the local levels about trying to set a floor and then have the upper form of government being able to recognize that if the lower wants to have higher standard, that they can. Because as it stands today, when you look at factory farming, you can't have more stringent regulations on factory farming than what the state allows. And so with environmental stuff, the push is to try to get a new form of environmental protections in place. So in essence, actually shift our view of how we protect the environment from being property to actually having rights. And I think the understanding is not about overthrowing the upper forms, but actually reorienting what the upper form, how it operates in relation to the lower. And again, a lot of this comes out of this understanding that if you don't have a degree of decision-making power at the local level, you've got this accumulation power happening at the higher level. Okay? So it's this rebalancing, this reorienting of the lower to the upper. And it's not about degrading rights, but about probably it's about setting a new floor and then being able to go above it. And so we hear the argument a lot saying, well, if you push this forward, it means the other guys over there are somehow going to make things worse because you're saying it's about making local decisions on everything. And that's not what's being gone after here. And in fact, when you look at it specifically, it's all been about corporate threats coming into communities. It's not about anything but that. So in essence, the ordinances themselves, they aim themselves at the proprietor, the one that's doing or are threatening to do what they want to be doing, which is the corporate entity at this point. So they've been very specific at looking at how that system enables that kind of actor within our system to operate, and begin to dismantle that and put a new system in place. Me personally, I think it's just another excuse not to do anything different, because there's this scenario. Let's build up these wild scenarios about what could be, and so then let's just stay with what is. And I think it's a natural thing for people to do, but I think we have to get over that kind of stuff too, to then really look at the true picture about who has the power. And are we that afraid of, well, in some ways, it's almost being afraid of one another. It's almost being afraid of democracy to a degree, that people are too dumb, too stupid to make their own decisions for themselves. Or I think is, once people know the information and they know what they're really connected to, they're going to make pretty wise decisions about the places where they're at. And I know people have this fear that somehow if we don't have that higher form dictating to the lower form, that all chaos is going to break out. And I think part of that, in my mind, at least when I do this work and I help out with the stuff, not only supporting groups in other places, but more directly with the folks in Spokane, to me it still comes down to having faith in people. And if you don't have faith in people, then why bother? And so there still has to be that degree of that you have to have faith in people, that they're going to make the kind of decisions that are really in their best interest. And part of that is to understand how the system works, to put things in front of them, and that at those decisions are going to be made in a way that are really going to be to the benefit not just of them, but of their community and of the ecosystems. The other way I also look at the rights of nature is it becomes this natural boundary of where man can progress to. You know, in essence, we have to live within the boundaries of what nature's systems say we should be living within, which is not what we do today. We think we're above the natural ecosystems. When you have to operate within actually validating the ecosystem's rights, it becomes this natural limiter about what we're actually capable of doing, because now we're part of that system. We're not separate from that system. So if anything, I think that could shift man's sort of view of itself and one another and how the environment has to be treated is really this huge paradigm shift around looking at the ecosystem as having rights. Maybe the limiter that we've actually needed through our own existence since time in memoriam about how man has done things, because we're not the first society to screw ourselves up. We just happen to do it to a level that may be the demise of us as a species. You know, other places have been able to wipe themselves out in one place and then relocate. We can't relocate unless we subscribe to Newt Gingrich and start colonizing the moon. We can start doing that. But, so, this is big stuff that you have to roll around your head for a while about what to do. It still comes down to what are people doing in the places that they're at. And I guess the point here to make tonight, if I were to emphasize or advocate for anything, is it's being done. People can do it. And I think those same people are going through this process that you guys may be going through too, about should we be doing something differently and how should we do it. So you're not alone in that aspect. In some ways, we're kind of into this next wave of communities doing this kind of work. So there's something to learn from, in essence. You know, what's amazing to me in this work and what I get inspired by is to think of these people in, you know, Licking Township, Pennsylvania, and Porter Township, Pennsylvania, 500-600 people sitting in their municipal building, which is the salt shed. So in the East Coast, they salt the roads. That's their city hall. So they're sitting in these buildings with fold-up chairs around the salt pile that's in there, you know, reading Thomas Paine and the Declaration of Independence, uh-huh. And looking at themselves in a very different light in relation to how the structure wants to look at, you know, how it wants to validate it, and passing this law. They were the first two communities to pass laws no longer recognizing corporations as people. This was in 2001, you know, and so I look at that stuff saying, holy shit, that's pretty badass, you know, and next thing you know, communities are doing the same, and you know, the lawmaking that we've helped with has evolved from that point, but it was their willingness to say no more, and so to me that's enough to say it can be done. Just that one, I mean, I don't have to look at the other 150 or 60 that have done it so far. Just for me, I just have to go back to that one small community and say that's enough for me and my own community to need to consider it to do differently. And it's enough a motivator for me when I go out to talk to other communities to reference that point in time of this work. So though it's new, it's not that new anymore, but there's still a long road ahead.
That was Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund organizer Kai Hushky of Spokane speaking with activists at the 1912 Center in Moscow. February 1st about a possible community bill of rights and ways to combat corporate political hegemony in communities. That's it for this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a pleasant weekend.